Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. That's right, you got reason to scream this morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron has a well-deserved day off as he flies back from his gig at Giggles. This is Morning Sedition. If you're just waking up, you're not dreaming. This is BET. Anyway, let us say, first of all, to start the broadcast, and we note this with a great deal of sadness, Peter Jennings, longtime anchorman, correspondent at ABC News, passed away last evening at the age of 67. This was obviously due to complications from lung cancer, which is what took him off the air earlier this year. Peter Jennings is one of those people that many Americans grew up watching. He was an extremely popular anchorman, in some instances a controversial anchorman, because he was an individual who was largely self-taught, which I always admired about him. He was thrown into a really bad situation at a very young age. He was 26 years old and thrown into an anchor battle with the likes of Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley, which was really a terrible position to be put in. But Peter Jennings, dead at the age of 67, and we're going to talk more about that as we go through our morning. The other big story going on as we speak, the shuttle. If you're just waking up, the shuttle was supposed to land about an hour and a half ago, actually, and then they pushed it back. It was due to land at 6:22 Eastern time. Now it will not land for 24 hours. Tomorrow morning is when the shuttle would land. This is a weather problem. This is not due to a problem with any mechanisms on the shuttle itself. So let's be clear about that so people don't think, oh, my God, there's something. No, there's nothing wrong with the shuttle. It is just that there was low cloud cover over the Kennedy Space Center, Cape Canaveral. And after thinking about it quite a bit, and obviously after the disaster of 03, they decided not to land the shuttle this morning. Dan Pashman is with us in studio this morning.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Good morning, Dan. How was the weekend?
It was good. It was good. Well, it was a lot of fun, although I had to suffer through two more defeats. My beloved Chicago Cubs, I've seen them play 8 times this season. They have lost all eight times.
Yeah. I think you are a jinx. Chris LaPresto, your loss, Dan Pashman, is Chris LaPresto's game.
It's true.
Because Chris LaPresto is a Mets fan, and he is grinning about as wide as a Cheshire cat can grin this morning.
Yes, we swept the Cubs. It was amazing.
Amazing. There
and
you go.
I went to Friday's game, and I caught a Derek Lee home run ball.
Whoa! What was that, number 32, 33?
Actually, this was a batting practice ball. But we can all just say it was number 32.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Everything's coming up K-Lo.
Yeah. Everything is not coming up Rafi, okay? Rafael Palmeiro may be in a little bit of trouble with the Congress of the United States. They have asked for his test records to find out exactly when he started using steroids, whether or not he perjured himself when he stood there in front of the Congress at a hearing and said, no, I did not take steroids, never, period. We know that's a lie because now he's tested positive. And there's real, I mean, he's really kind of caught out there, folks.
Yeah,
did you say?
Absolutely, Mark. It's pretty interesting to see what's happening. And I personally think they really want to make an example out of Palmeiro. Major League Baseball wants to make an example out of him. And the politicians in Washington see this, as they did with those hearings they had a few months ago. It's an opportunity to get their names in the paper again. It's a pretty easy issue because most people agree with them. And people in both parties can come together and say, look, we're doing something to make you Americans happy. They get their name in the paper. And Palmeiro is in big, big trouble because I think they're really going to go after him, the Congress and Major League Baseball. They're going to use him for the example.
Yeah. They won't say yet he perjured himself, Chris, but it seems pretty obvious that his statements are in conflict with each other.
Yeah.
If I was him, I would pray for a 50 or 100-game suspension because I would not want to go back out on that field. Because the fans are just going to rip him a new one.
Yeah, I imagine. Speaking of getting ripped a new one, George W. Bush has some really bad poll numbers. We're going to get into this later this morning. But I want people that are waking up this morning to know that your colleagues, your friends, your people across America are starting to get on the train that says George W. Bush lied about Iraq, has no plan for Iraq, and more Americans are starting to say, you know what, we need to stop this and stop this now.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact that there was a situation down in his ranch in Crawford. He thought he was going to get, you know, his 50th quiet vacation over the last 5 years. Fat chance.
Yeah.
Cindy Sheehan, who we talked about quite a bit before, she lost her son Casey in Iraq. She has conducted what I guess for many people is a one-person crusade against the war and against President Bush's stewardship of that war. Well, she's camped out as we speak in Crawford, Texas. She met with two top White House officials on Saturday afternoon for about 45 minutes, which means, by the way, it means several things. And we're going to get into that later on this morning as well, because it really does mean a bunch of things. There are people that are afraid, switching topics real quickly, people are afraid that the London bombers may have been trying to send a message to New York. At least some people are afraid, some people in the NYPD. We're going to talk later this morning with journalist David Jimmer, who is from London, about that and about whether or not that's just, what do they say in England, so much bosh? You know what I'm saying? Because it really is a very, very strange scenario and a kind of strange thing that they appear to be constructing about some message that was being sent by the London bombers because they had New York gear on.
Right.
And, of course, there is also news this morning that the Saudis warned the Brits about the July 7th bombing, which is a little strange. And we'll talk with David about that as well. And, of course, we've also got, in addition, by the way, to Cindy Sheehan speaking out against the war, an increasing number of Iraq veterans are starting to speak out about the war. We'll talk about the peace convention that they had over the weekend. And we also have a story, and I know this will pertain to you New Yorkers in the House, about some gases they were going to, the federal government just apparently decided to emit about six times throughout Midtown Manhattan. The government says that New Yorkers were given adequate and fair warning about this. Other people say, not so fast. I don't think so. So we're going to talk about that as well, because there's some people that are saying that the local government was slipshod in letting people know about these tests that are going to be going on. Mm-hmm. The leak investigation, Rove Gate, Plain Gate, however gate you want to describe, has hit a bit of a snag because somebody is moving on and there's no real overseer. And I hopefully that will not stop the investigation into this treason that has taken place in the release of Valerie Plame's name. And the overall attempt to see, because this is really part of a larger scenario that we're looking at here. And that is the question of the lengths to which the Bush administration would go to discredit its opposition. And we see, and by the way, we're going to tie this into Cindy Sheehan as well, because while the Bush White House may send two senior officials to talk with her, the bottom line is that you're going to see a bunch of right-wing talk show hosts throughout the day today savaging this woman. Mm-hmm. They will dig up whatever it is, whatever there is to dig up about this woman, and they're going to do Bush's work for him. He's going to pull out the velvet hand, but believe me, the hammer is going to come from the right-wing talk show host. And there are questions about Scooter Libby and exactly whose source, what the source was about the plane leak, because there's word now that perhaps Scooter Libby was Judith Miller's source.
Yes.
As she sits in jail. And there's a question as to whether or not Tom DeLay and President Bush, actually whether President Bush, has managed to completely scuttle the investigation into one Jack Abramoff, who, of course, is Tom DeLay's boy and who was allegedly caught up in some scandal both in Washington, D.C., and in Texas. And, you know, how the Beltway, Dan, sometimes seems to cover itself. That seems to be what's going on in that Abramoff thing.
Absolutely. It's one of those things. I mean, everything we've read and learned about Abramoff, and this guy was someone that no one outside the Beltway had ever heard of until very recently. All of a sudden, he's a big-time name with all these scandals going around. And, I think it's coming out just how huge of a figure Abramoff was within the GOP fundraising circles, just how important this guy was to their machinery. He was the money man lobbyist. This guy was the number one connection between officials, elected officials in Washington, and major donor groups and interest groups that were funneling money through various nefarious means. And Bush, as quiet as he liked to keep it, was helping to protect Abramoff when he sidelined that investigation.
That's right. That was Jack Abramoff really was the off-ramp to the Beltway.
Yeah.
And all that implies. When we come back, I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to say that. Coming up next, we're going to talk about this poll that is more bad news for George W. Bush on Iraq.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, we haven't heard any good news about George W. Bush as far as the polls are concerned. The American people are getting off the bus, and
yes,
we'll tell you why next here on Air America Radio.
Mornings Edition.
It's just a wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Just a few minutes ago have now come back out and are standing in a group of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 men and an Olympic security guard outside speaking, while on adjacent buildings, dressed in athlete suits, occasional what I would suspect are marksmen or sharpshooters from some German security agency have taken up position on a roof adjacent to the Israeli building. That delegation has come out again. No indication whatsoever from looking at them whether they have accomplished anything or not.
That is the late Peter Jennings, who died last evening at the age of 67 due to complications from lung cancer. That was one of the high points of Peter Jennings' career, and it was a very tragic high point, obviously. That was Peter Jennings at the Munich Olympics in September 1972. This is Morning's Edition. It's 21 minutes past the hour. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is not fired, ladies and gentlemen. He is on his way home. Dan Patrick was with us in the studio. I just want to make sure, because, you know, if when people hear me by myself sometimes, folks say, well, wait a minute, where the hell is Matt? Well, he's on his way back. He will be back with us tomorrow. Dan Patrick's here. Chris Lopresto's here. Brendan McDonald's here.
Yes.
B-Mac. I'm not going to call him P.W. McDonald like Marin. I like B-Mac better. You know, give him a hip-hop moniker. You know, a little hustle and flow action. And then we've got the two giants, David and Goliath, who are with us in studio as well. And we've got some great guests coming up for you later this morning. We want to say a special good morning to two, not one, but two,
yes,
new Air America Radio affiliates. Starting today, we are on in Missoula, Montana on KNS-FM. That's 105.9 News and Progressive Talk. And KSZL, 1230 a.m. in Victor Valley, California. Now,
hello.
The other, yeah, good morning to all of y'all. And, of course, we also want to make sure that people know that the space shuttle will be not landing this morning, because actually it's 6:22 Eastern time. This was the time it was supposed to be coming down.
Yes.
Well, it's been put on 24-hour hiatus. We don't know exactly where they're going to be going for the next 24 hours, but it won't be back to Earth. They will be coming back tomorrow morning at around this time. We'll certainly bring you all late details of that. Dan Pashman, Bush,
yes,
is in trouble.
He's going down, man. He is seriously going down. The veneer is finally starting to peel away, Riley.
It's
a little sad and frustrating that it took this damn long.
But
I guess better late than never. I think a lot of Americans are finally starting to wake up and realize just how badly we were lied to and deceived with regard to this Iraq war. And
that's what people are saying,
right,
at this point. We're talking now about 61% disapproving of Bush's handling of Iraq. That is the highest disapproval rate since the start of the war. 50% say we are losing ground in Iraq. Half. And we'd like to say to those who are coming on board recently, welcome.
Yes.
We've known this all along. 54% are dissatisfied with the direction things are going inside the U.S. That's the most since the Abu Ghraib scandal in May of 2004. 64% think Iraq has not made the U.S. safer from terrorism. That's the most since the start of the Iraq war.
That's one of the really big ones, right? I want to pause for a moment there. That, the notion, that is really, when you sum it all up, the weapons of mass destruction, Saddam, et cetera, all the reasons that we were sold this war.
Bill of goods.
Can all be summed up as, this relates to the war on terror. If we take over Iraq, it will make you safer. That was, when you sum it all up and boil it down, when they were the march towards beginning, that was what Bush sold the war to the American people on. This will make us safer from terrorism. 64% now say Iraq has not made the U.S. safer from terrorism.
1,800 U.S. lives. And President Bush has now had to pay very specific attention to one life.
Mm-hmm.
That was the life of young Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Iraq, and whose mom, Cindy Sheehan, is not stopping in her criticism of George W. Bush. She started last year, and we reported on the fact,
right,
that last year she was very, very vocal essentially taking Bush to task for his handling of the Iraq war and questioning why her son and other mothers' sons had to die over there and exactly what the purpose was. And she has not stopped. She took a bus with impeach something on the side.
The impeachmobile or something like that.
The impeachmobile from Vacaville, California. To Crawford, Texas, and she decided to, hang out in front of Bush's ranch entrance. Of course, she was blocked from getting inside the compound.
Of course.
But the Bush administration did not simply decide to, as they did with Valerie Plame, just sort of, or actually with Joe Wilson, just try to, completely gut the woman right off the top. They decided instead to send two top aides, Stephen Hadley, who, by the way, is the National Security Advisor and a protege of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
Right.
And a deputy press relations person by the name of Joe Nagrin, I believe.
Hagan,
I'm sorry.
Deputy White House Chief of Staff.
Deputy White House Chief of Staff. These are heavyweight people we're talking about here.
Yeah. That says to me, Rod, I'm not sure what you think, but I this says to me that they are scared of this woman, Cindy Sheehan. They are scared of what she can do in the public's eye, and they know that she is not going to take no for an answer. For them to send out the National Security Advisor, that's what Condi Rice was before she became Secretary of State.
Yeah.
And a Deputy White House Chief of Staff out to this woman who's standing at the gates. These are not the first protesters we've seen in Crawford, but the first ones that have attracted this kind of high-level attention.
Yes, and they have attracted a level of attention. And Cindy Sheehan met with these gentlemen for about 45 minutes, Joe Hagan and Stephen Hadley, on Saturday afternoon. And after it was all over, I think... that the White House figures, okay, well, we'll send these two guys out, they'll talk to her, and she'll leave. No such luck! She's decided to stay until the President of the United States comes out, or until he leaves Crawford and goes back to D.C.
Right.
So she's going to be out there for a minute, and she's going to continue to attract attention. And it's interesting, she came from that Veterans for Peace National Convention in Dallas.
Right.
Now, that Veterans for Peace Convention was an extraordinary gathering, certainly in the wake of 27 U.S. soldiers dying in Iraq over the last recent days. So that we're going to get into a little bit later. And coming up next, we're going to talk to an academic, a media academic and journalist, about what's going on in London, whether or not that New York stuff has any validity whatsoever, the warning that allegedly Saudi Arabia gave to the Britons about the July 7th bombing, and a whole lot more. David Jimmer joins us when we come back here on Air America Radio. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on his way home from Seattle. He'll be back with us tomorrow. Join us, Mark and I, this Friday as we broadcast live from O'Neill's on 64th Street between Broadway and Central Park West. We've got the usual free coffee and other cool giveaways. Stay tuned for more details. That's this Friday, 6 to 9 a.m. at O'Neill's on West 64th Street. Lot going on, ladies and gentlemen, this morning. Of course, the shuttle has been postponed. The shuttle landing has been postponed for 24 hours. Peter Jennings, if you're just waking up, passed away late last evening from complications due to lung cancer. And, of course, there are a lot of eyes in the United States that are on Great Britain right now. This past Friday, Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, issued a radical set of proposals for dealing with extremism in England, specifically some of the Islamic extremism, and that's to use a euphemism, to deal with the idea that there are some people in Britain that are preaching hate, and Tony Blair wants to deal with them in a pretty radical way. Our next guest is a senior academic at one of the UK's leading media universities, the University of Westminster. He's reported for the BBC, Channel 4, and ABC's South Africa Bureau. Pleasure to welcome to our microphones Mr. David Jimmer. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Mark.
Thanks
and,
a lot for being with
yeah,
us.
I used to a very long time ago.
A long time.
The BBC's and Channel 4. So
absolutely.
That's the correct.
Now, Tony Blair's war on terror. He came out Friday before leaving on vacation, ironically enough, with a very, very tough set of proposals. He wants to introduce new laws to deport extremist Muslim clerics without appeal, close down mosques that are determined to have been preaching hate, ban certain Muslim groups, and create a new offense of glorifying terrorism in Britain or abroad. Pretty tough measures. Are most Britons behind them?
They're split. I mean, particularly, I mean, from a parliamentary point of view, after the particular events of July the 7th, there was a rallying call from all the opposition, which is both the Conservatives and the Liberals. The Liberals have since said that they're very uncomfortable with the laws that he's trying to implement. And they very much said, don't expect our support. I think from the Muslim community, there's some degree of tension there. They still think one of the things that really got their goat was this idea, and it's been bandying around, but it's been pulled back now, this idea of racial profiling, to the extent that, one senior police of the exec of the London Transport of the Underground made the point that, you know, we are going to be targeting ethnic minorities.
Yeah, in other words, we're not going to search any white ladies.
Yeah, yeah,
I think that's how he described
it.
They backed off of that?
They haven't, but they're, for what it's worth, I would probably say they're being very clever with their language. And that means that, you know, do not use the word racial profiling, I mean, because it's so politically charged. But they have made the point. The term they now use, particularly one of the very senior members of the Commission of Metropolitan Police, used the word, clever intelligence or something to that effect.
Uh-huh.
Intelligence-led or something like that.
Oh, intelligence-led. Now, let me ask you something about what Blair is talking about. Because here, if someone said that you were going to start deporting people without appeal and closing down houses of worship, there would be a big hue and cry. There are 1.6 million Muslims inside Britain. Do they feel that the line perhaps between being critical of the British government and hate has now been moved against them?
There's some disquiet. I mean, the association isn't a comfortable one. Incidentally, by the way, the French, you'll remember from the onset of this, they made the point that, quite frankly, they don't see why the Brits aren't as belligerent or as fastidious as they are. I mean, they've been deporting clerics, etc., for years on end.
Okay.
So as far as they were concerned, you know, Britain was just being too liberal. So, for them, it hasn't come a moment too soon that, you know, finally Britain's got its act together. There is something about coming up with laws in not so much in a knee-jerk fashion, but as soon as an event takes place.
Okay.
Many years ago, we had one over bulldogs. Bulldogs started savaging people, and then so they came up with this law on muzzling bulldogs. Likewise, the thinking is that there needs to be more time, more thought that goes into this. Otherwise, you actually start getting the wrong people.
But can politicians really afford to take that time, or do they have to respond immediately in the event that something happens so they don't get blamed for it?
Well, that's the conundrum. That's the between the hard stone and the rock. That on the one hand, they have to be seen to be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got to get some laws. They've got to try and assuage the public, the citizens, telling them they're on the ball. On the other hand, there are other parliamentaries, there are civil rights groups, etc., who are saying that, you know, this IA, first, it's too soon. Secondly, the laws are just too draconian.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I suppose the job, therefore, of a politician is this balancing act, whereby you kind of toe this middle line, the third way, for want of a better word,
mm-hmm.
where you try on the one hand appease one group and do the other. My feeling on this issue is that there is no, a phrase that Margaret Thatcher used many years ago, there is no turning back. I think Blair has got the bit between his teeth. And he's going to push
it. And he's going to run with it.
Yeah.
Now, you were in London at the end of last week when there was a great step up in terms of the visible police presence, both in the tubes, on the subway, and on the streets of London. What was that like? Did you feel like you were running a gauntlet getting to work?
It's a really interesting question. Interesting because, as far as Britain's concerned, we've never really had armed police visible. Mm-hmm. It's just never happened. Interesting question for me because, having lived in places like South Africa, where, you know, it's pretty prevalent.
Prevalent, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, being to the States on the other occasion and seeing, you know, holsters, guns, you know, it, 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 I'm tempted to say I wasn't that shocked, but just to be sitting down in the tube and seeing a guy going by with an MP3 or whatever it is they carry, looking at you, and you trying to look away, pretty scary. Pretty scary stuff. And the last Thursday, I suppose the pattern has been, because one was the Thursday, and then the Thursday that followed, there was another attempt. Mm-hmm. The Thursday seemed to be a kind of a this convergence of high-profile yellow vests with guys with guns. So I've seen other reports there that suggest that the public actually welcome that, because there's some assurance, therefore, that they feel that if somebody...
They feel safer, in other words.
Yeah.
do they feel safer with racial profiling? There are some people who believe that, and this has turned up as an issue here in New York, that racial profiling, while it may be an inexact science, does have the effect of making people feel safer. We're going after these people that are trying to hurt us. Is that at all a sentiment or an emotion in Britain?
I think it's split many ways. I mean, there will be communities who feel very strong and are probably... I'll tread very carefully here, are probably very, very English. And I've heard sentiments that have been expressed that, this is wrong, and to the point that get them out, get these particular ethnic groups who they feel are responsible for this, get them out of the country. I mean, it has raised a level of xenophobia like there's, it hasn't happened in a while. I guess, on the other hand, you have, liberals or for... I don't care what you call them.
Libertarians,
whatever. Yeah, but you have people who just don't feel that that's the right way to go about trying to, stoke the fire, trying to make amends, trying to find a solution for what's going on.
Well, in the case of the July 7th bombings, you're talking about British Pakistanis. I mean, these were people who I believe were born in Britain. Their parents were from Pakistan. So, I mean, how do you deport somebody who was born inside the country?
I mean, it reminds me very much of the incident with the sprinter many years ago, who was Ben Johnson. Mm-hmm. He was Canadian at one point and then became Jamaican.
Yeah.
After the transgression, and to an extent, what's happening here is you have British Pakistanis who become Pakistanis overnight entirely because of the events that took place. You can't. There is no solution for trying to say, we're going to kick these people out. I think what the law they're trying to use will try and do. And there have been a few sheikhs and clerics, being few clerics and imams in the UK who have, in public spaces, been able to preach very vociferously.
There are certain mosques, like the Finsbury Park Mosque in North London, has an international reputation for at least hosting people that say this sort of thing. Do you think that they're going to close that and other mosques that have that kind of reputation?
No, I don't.
No,
I think politically, that's too highly charged.
But Blair would get the proposal that Blair is talking about would give the government power to do that.
Now, if you're referring to the the Finsbury Park Mosque. I beg your pardon. Yes, I was actually thinking about the one in Regent Park. Yeah, I mean, those where they feel there are problems, I don't see why they won't deal a heavy hand there. But they've got the bit between their teeth, and they're determined that, Britain won't experience what went on in the last couple of weeks. So they'll do as much as they can to stem this. And as you alluded there, I suspect, they're busily sort of, dotting I's and crossing T's as we speak to go in and do what they need to do.
Quick thing on another subject. You met Peter Jennings when you were working at ABC in South Africa. Of course, for those of you just waking up, Peter Jennings passed away last night at the age of 67 from lung cancer. What were your impressions of Peter Jennings?
Yeah, I was around 94. I was with an associate producer for the term where South Africa had its elections going and was just going through its first democratic election. So I was at their bureau in Johannesburg. And he walked inside, and obviously I'd seen him in the past on television, much taller than I thought. I just started watching American football then, so I thought he looked like a really good quarterback. But he was very gracious. He sort of went around the room saying hello, and we all sort of said hello, very sort of doughy-eyed looking at him. And I don't know him at all, other than the fact that he passed by and said hello. So, but like many Americans and many other people who know him dearly, very sad indeed.
Very sad, for sure. David Jimmer, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Very much. Thank you very much indeed.
Now, coming up, the Radio Theater Temple of Doom. This is the startling conclusion of the Morning Sedition Radio Theater. We're going to have it for you. We've also got the liberal agenda. Just because Maron's not here, that doesn't mean we don't have the liberal agenda. That means we have not abandoned the funny. You'll find out why, and you'll find out some of that funny next here on Air America Radio. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio. Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of Marc Maron and the Temple of Doom. In the exciting conclusion to our story, Mark and Grace have discovered that the Antichrist is Jay Leno. Yes, I know. Big surprise. Anyway, Mark said something wrong as usual, and now Jay Leno is bringing about the end times.
So, Mark and Grace, you followed Marilyn Manson to the portal of Hades, or as it's known by its official name, The Tonight Show, and you've guessed my identity. So now you have two choices. You can become part of my covert satanic army and go forth and do my bidding, then go to hell. All right, take your soul right now and down you go.
Hey, what about me?
I don't think so. Marilyn, everyone in hell says you creep them out.
Wait a minute. Satan has a covert army on Earth?
Oh, yeah. We have thousands of people out there in every area. Politics, law enforcement, internet, even air conditioning repair, ironically enough. You name it. There are some you might have guessed already. Dick Cheney, George Bush, Karl Rove, Fred Phelps, Emeril Lagasse, Judge Judy, the actor who played Teacher on Saved by the Bell, and that mean guy at your deli, Mark. You know, the one who never puts mustard on your sandwich, no matter how many times you ask him. Always conveniently forgets to give you a pickle.
I thought that guy just hated me.
No, he's one of my minions. He's pure evil. So what's it going to be, a lifetime in service to the horned beast, the dark angel? Oh, yeah, ready to take the express to hell, no waiting.
Wait a minute. If you're the Antichrist, I want to see some proof. Transform yourself into something evil, horrible, and hideous right in front of our eyes.
Okay, no problem.
You're on the air with Satan, Dark Lord, ruler of the netherworld, and proud Republican.
Good enough?
I don't care if you're the Antichrist or not. You don't scare me. I've lived in Hollywood. You're not going to take us without a fight.
Mark, I'm Satan. Dark forces, evil incarnate. There's nothing you can do. There's only one person who's my match.
Here's Jesus.
Step off, Beezle bitch. These are friends of mine, unlike you. I always like Letterman more.
Yeah, that's ancient history, just like you.
Ugh, you don't think I got it anymore?
Bring it, old man.
You are so middle of the road, you should have a line down your back.
Yeah, well, your delivery is worse than the post office in Belusia.
I don't want to say you're white bread, but your jokes build strong bodies 12 ways.
Your jokes are so old, your cue cards are in hieroglyphics.
All right, you asked for it. It was so hot today.
How hot was it?
Police in New York were checking people's ice packs.
It was so hot that I got nothing. You win.
Now that we all know you're the Antichrist, Mark and Grace can get the word out. I've got to get back to heaven. I'm meeting Marilyn Monroe for drinks at 7.
Hey, thank her for letting me use half of her name.
So that's it for the Antichrist.
That's right, Grace. We're going to tell the world that Jay Leno is the bringer of evil. Might as well get used to it, Leno. Your reign of deceit has ended. It's over. Finished. You've lost.
Yeah, that's fine. Say, Mark, do you want to do the show sometime?
Sure. September is wide open.
Mark?
This has been Marc Maron and the Temple of Doom. Our bizarre and adventurous story starred Marc Maron and Catherine Sardina, and co-starred in alphabetical order Doug Desher, Jim Earle, Mike Ferrucci, Wayne Gilman, Kent Jones, Barry Lank, Brendan McDonald, Deanna Neal, Dan Pashman, Zach Polakoff, Mark Riley, Carmen Shamwell, Mishnah Wolf, and probably 6 or 7 other people we forgot. Our engineers were Brendan McDonald and Doug Desher. I'm Barry Lank, your announcer. Thanks for tuning in, tip your waitress, and stay tuned later for the Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company's production of A Streetcar Named Desire, with Mark Riley as Blanche Dubois and Marc Maron as Stanley Kowalski.
These are love letters yellowing with antiquity, all from one boy. Poems a dead boy wrote. I hurt him the way you would like to hurt me, but you can't. I'm not young and vulnerable anymore, but my young husband was. Everyone has something they won't let others touch because of their intimate nature.
All right, good effort, man. Good effort, Riley. Good.
Stella!
That's coming up later on Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
Oh, my God. What was it? Did somebody feed me some happy gas or something? It's 54 minutes past the hour. And right now, I want to let people know that it's time for the liberal agenda. Just because Maron's not here, by the way, he hasn't been fired. But Ken Jones is here to do the liberal agenda for us. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, everyone. Liberal soldiers, listen up. Here are your marching orders from the Streisand compound. One, say you support intelligent design, but only when it refers to mountain bikes and espresso machines. Two, protest the Dukes of Hazzard's car because the General Lee isn't a hybrid vehicle. Okay. Three, have Crawford Ranch redistricted as a no-work zone. Four, call Robert Novak a tool and see if he flips out again. Five, to compete with all those people naming everything after Ronald Reagan, go around the country naming roads and parks after Michael Dukakis. Today's phrase, just dropping into conversation. Hey, all you moms who went to Bush's ranch to protest the war, you're wasting your time. Wake up, sheeple. Don't you realize nothing gets accomplished at Crawford ever? That's what it's for. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kent Jones. Now, listen, we got fun-filled 2 hours still left on Morning Sedition.
We got a guy on hold right now, Riley, that I'm very excited to talk to around the corner.
Oh!
Brian from Everett is already ready. Oh. Already.
Already ready.
Yes.
Yes, and I understand he went to Mark Maron's performance at Giggles.
That's right.
Yeah, the gig at Giggles.
He's going to give us a review.
Oh, God, you're scaring me now. You know that. Also coming up in the next hour, Tom Robbins, staff writer with the Village Voice, joins us to discuss the future of unions in the U.S. Tom is writing a piece for this week's Voice about that split off of the SEIU and the Teamsters from the AFL-CIO, and I'm not going to, I promise I will not mention that many abbreviated letters for the rest of the show, okay? We've also got later on Charles R. Cross, author of Room Full of Mirrors, a new biography of Jimi Hendrix, and David Poland, our favorite movie person, editor of Movie City News and columnist for The Hot Button. He's going to talk about the movies and the latest out of Hollywood.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to that, hear about that Hendrix guy. I read the piece in Rolling Stone that just came out last week that was an excerpt from his book, and just learning more about Hendrix. I mean, obviously I'm familiar with his music, but to be honest, I didn't know that much about who he was as a person or his very early days and his rise to fame and his arrival in London and what happened in such a short amount of time.
That's always embedded in my head because I heard that at a very early age. Twisted my mind, that's for sure. So we've got more coming for you. Don't go anywhere. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 minutes past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on his way home from a gig at Giggles Comedy Club in Seattle. He will be back with us tomorrow. And we've got some news for you if you're just waking up, because, you know, a lot of people that have to do the 9 o'clock thing, you get up around 7. So we want you to know, first of all, that Peter Jennings, longtime anchorman of ABC's World News Tonight, has passed away at the age of 67. The shuttle has been delayed for 24 hours. Those of you who woke up expecting it to be on the ground, no, it is going to be actually landing tomorrow. This is not due to any fault of the shuttle itself. It's due to weather conditions down there at the Kennedy Space Center. Also passing away, Ibrahim Ferrer, one of the co-founders of the Buena Vista Social Club. Those of you who are into music, and perhaps those of you who are into film as well, saw some or heard some of the music or saw the film about the Buena Vista Social Club. And former British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, a man who gained a great deal of notoriety when he decided to step off from the Blair administration because of Blair's support of Bush's Iraq war. Robin Cook is dead of unknown causes at the relatively young age of 59. Dan Pashman, good morning to you.
Morning, Mark. How are you?
All right. Good morning, Chris Lopresto.
What's up, baby?
How you doing, man?
I'm good, honey.
All right. Honey. Honey. My wife don't call me honey. No, she calls me dear. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
And I hope everyone has had a great weekend. And right now, you know, Marc Maron, as we mentioned, was out in Seattle performing. And there was someone who actually went to see the show and can tell us a little bit about it. Some of you may remember Brian from Everett, Washington. For those of you who do not know him, he is famous for his songs Inconsistent Mental Disposition, Al Franken, King of the Jews, and what was the other one?
Go Time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Go Time. That's right.
Know, hey, are you there?
Yeah, Brian, how you doing?
This is how I build my career. I don't understand people who have to, like, go through channels and agents and stuff. You know, just blow it out there.
That's right.
No, really, you know, it was, oh, man, it was, I laughed at the show, and the girls were good, the girl comics were good, but Marc Maron, I mean, what he had to totally dismantle my delusional frames of existence, and so that means, you know, an extra pill for me when I get home.
and then
he mentioned the pill. He mentioned the medication, and so he mentioned. I mean, talk about totally validating all my issues, you know, and then leaving me naked like a little brain nerves, you know, twisting in the wind. But oh, it was hilarious, though. I loved it.
Wow, that sounds like it was a pretty intense experience for you, Brian.
Oh, no, it was, you know, like me, I'm just, you know, I've chosen autism as a spiritual path.
No, wait a minute, Brian, let me get this straight. Did Maron actually mention you from the stage?
Yeah, well, he said, this is the thing, it's like, he said, oh, by the way, and he gets up to do a set. Oh, Brian from Everett is here. And then there's like a little contingent of girls. I thought, oh, my gosh, I've got girls. Contingent of girls is like saying yay, yay, yay. And I must have been like a church group or something over there on the side.
Did you get any digits out of the deal? Did you get any phone numbers, Brian?
You mean to actually live and do something with life? No.
Well, not yet. You're supposed to talk to them. See, now, when you find out that women are into you, you're supposed to zero in on those women and say, hey.
But what's the plural? What's the plural? I just want, I mean, yeah, I don't know, man. I just need one.
All you had to do was pick one.
Well, but I do have other things to tell you that I met.
Moving on from the topic of Brian.
Abstinence, huh, Brian?
It's just cowardice. I don't know, that's what morals really are anyway, I guess. But
morals are cowardice? You know, that's an interesting frame. Morals are cowardice. Wow.
But I'll tell you what, though. I met his Marc Maron's wife's uncle was there, and he bought me a beer, which I probably should have asked for a pop, you know? So I was on the guest list, so the dude in charge knew who I was, so he bought me, and then there's a one drink minimum. Well, I only had $1. It's like, and the guy behind me, that's his wife's uncle, is like, well, okay, I'll buy you a drink, Ryan.
Wait, you went out with $1 in your pocket?
Are the buses free after a certain time?
No, yeah. I had $1. I have a reduced fare pass. I have the retard pass. You know? So, that's a long story, you know.
I know. We don't have time for that one this morning. But did you make any music out of this trip, Ryan?
Well, I don't have a song. I was thinking about a song I might bring on tomorrow. I was going to rhyme Conan. You'll never make it on Conan with artificial serotonin. But for me, it's just a phone-in.
I think you might be the first person ever to rhyme anything with serotonin in a song.
Yeah,
because,
really.
So, of course, I just take the pills until there's either I get healed or there's some kind of massive geopolitical upheaval. I don't take my pills anymore. Protect me from the wiles of the psychiatrist.
Right? Wait a minute. Let me get this straight, Brian. You stopped taking the pills at any international disaster. Is that what you said? I mean, in other words.
No. I didn't. No, when I say upheaval, I mean peace. I mean, there's gonna be, if there's peace on earth and goodwill towards man, then I won't need to take the pills anymore.
I see.
He's talking like Armageddon upheaval.
Oh, you're looking like you're the only one left, kind of upheaval.
Well. I don't know. It's like when Marc Maron's talking about liberalism, I don't know about left and right wing. It's just the ones that we ain't got yet. You know, we're ones that are left who've got something original in our brains. That's all, man.
So, Brian, before we let you go, we got to wrap up this review of Maron's performance in Seattle on Saturday night. One star being the worst, five stars being the best. Give us a rating.
Well, I give it 4.5 or 5. I mean, you know, it was, you know, I just laughed. And I tried to make sure I laughed you know, in the quiet moment so Mark Maron could hear me laugh. So he would know that he made me laugh, and then so, you know, he would know that he did something good, you know. It's just really, you know. But, and I'm assuming now Mark Maron is curled up in an alley somewhere in Seattle. Like, he's really... Is that true?
I don't know. He might be at the airport, curled up in the corner somewhere.
We're hoping it's not true. We expect him to be back tomorrow. But thanks a lot for your call,
thanks
Brian.
Thanks for the call, Brian.
Okay, have a good one.
Take
all
care.
Right, take care. Wow. So that must have, you know, I hope that didn't freak Marin out too much. Having someone with an inconsistent mental disposition.
I love that Marin mentioned his name and girls in the corner started screaming Brian's name. That's the most awesome thing ever.
And the man has morals, so he didn't get any phone numbers?
Right.
What, was he drunk?
No, he said it was cowardice, not morals.
Oh, cowardice.
He was honest about
maybe
it.
Maybe he didn't have any. I mean, he had no dollars, man. You can't really woo somebody with a dollar.
No, you can. You just have to be really good at it.
Chris, well, maybe we need to take a segment to get some pointers from Chris Lopresto over here.
How to pick up a chick with $1 in your pocket.
In pocket, yeah. What do? Give him some of them noodles you buy at Costco? What do you do? How do you
among other things, Riley, right? I think you'll never understand.
Oh, wait a minute now. Let's not get... Well, that's all right. We all signed the agreement, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, that leak investigation is in trouble.
Oh, yeah. We got some big issues with that thing, Riley.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, this is a leak investigation that really needs to come to some kind of conclusion. Now, we don't expect it to, you know, to happen tomorrow or whatever. But with the defection of one of the most important people in Patrick Fitzgerald's office, we got a problem on our hands. Whether the investigation is going to go forward, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk a bit about Peter Jennings. We're going to talk about the delay of the shuttle, and we're also going to bring Kent Jones back in for the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi translator. That cannot be trusted to me. I need someone to translate these headlines for me because, quite frankly, in some instances, they make my head hurt. All right. So we got all that coming up for you next here on Air America Radio.
Oh, Franken. Nothing to lose. Makes you laugh at the troubling news. Sometimes I wonder if he's hitting the booze. Al Franken, King of the Jews.
Air America Radio.
Yeah, 19 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on his way home from Seattle. He has not been fired. He will be here with us tomorrow morning. First thing, join Morning's Edition this Friday when we broadcast live from O'Neill's on 64th Street between Broadway and Central Park West in the borough of Manhattan. The richest county in America, by the way. We'll have free coffee and other cool giveaways. Stay tuned for more details. That's this Friday, 6 to 9 a.m. at O'Neill's on West 64th Street. I will be there. Mark Maron will be there. Don't even think about trying to touch me. Kent Jones is here with us. He has got...
You can't touch me either.
Can't touch me. That's right. I forget it. That's an old rap lyric. Kent Jones, you've got the latest news translations because all of this stuff that's going on this morning is making my head hurt, man. Make it plain.
I understand. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. Luckily, Mark Maron has a super fine iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up. Feed it some headlines. Yes, from the Associated Press. Poll, fewer Americans think Bush is honest. Okay, poll, fewer Americans think Bush is honest. Translation, truth virus spreading. Threatens cherished myths. From the Chicago Sun-Times, Novak apologizes for cursing, walking off. All right, Novak apologizes for cursing, walking off. Translation, Novak, I'm sorry for my bull behavior. From the Associated Press, Saudi says ties to U.S. couldn't be better. Saudi says ties to U.S. couldn't be better. And the translation, Saudi calls Bush worth every penny.
Oh. Thank you very much, Ken Jones.
Thanks, Ken.
Happy to help.
All right. Now, we know about this little leak probe that's been going on for a while. And it looks like, and I misspoke a little bit earlier, I made it sound like the person that's leaving, who is Deputy Attorney General James Comey, actually worked for Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald. It's the other way around.
Right.
Comey was supervising Patrick Fitzgerald's probe. He is leaving to take the job of General Counsel at Ka-ching, Lockheed Martin.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, has some problems of its own, which we won't get into here. But it does leave a question mark in terms of exactly who is going to be supervising that investigation. One person that will not be Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. He recused himself. So department officials are now trying to figure out who Fitzgerald, or let me use the Old English 800 translation, whom Fitzgerald will now report to. Associate Attorney General Robert McCallum is likely to be named as an acting Deputy Attorney General. However, he may have his own conflicts. He's an old friend of the president's. He was a member of his Skull and Bones class at Yale University. And the other question, of course, is how much authority Comey's successor will have over Fitzgerald. You know, this is taking on the overtones, Dan Pashman, of a movie called Z that came out many years ago, where a crusading prosecutor decides to look into a situation, and everyone around him tells him, look, you know, you really need to get off of this thing.
Right.
Now, this opening seems to leave the possibility that someone will be supervising Patrick Fitzgerald that might have their own agenda here.
It's true. It's very, it's got me a little nervous. I could see the whole gamut of results out of this situation because, as we know now, James Comey, the guy who's stepping down, he has given Fitzgerald a tremendous amount of leeway to conduct this investigation however he sees fit.
Mm-hmm.
And that has given Fitzgerald this freedom to conduct what I think is really shaping up to be an impressive, a fearless and a thorough investigation of the release of Valerie Plame's identity as a CIA operative. But we could have a new guy come in who could continue the status quo, give Fitzgerald as much leeway as he needs, or could shut him down almost entirely or anything in between.
I would think that with the kind of public spotlight that's going on here, that they would be really stupid to bring somebody in to try and rein Patrick Fitzgerald. It would look really obvious and extremely ham-handed, but the Bush administration is not necessarily known for finesse.
Yeah, that doesn't always stop them before, right?
No, it certainly hasn't.
You're right. I don't think they'll have the nads to try to shut it down entirely, only because, like you said, it would create that would be like throwing gasoline on the fire.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there's a possibility they'll try to restrict it. And this guy Fitzgerald has really impressed me. He is hardcore. I read one article that compared him actually to Elliot Ness.
Really?
They brought him into Chicago with all this corruption in Chicago. They brought him into Chicago to be the prosecutor out there. They said, we need a guy who cannot be bought. And Patrick Fitzgerald was the guy that was recommended for that position. And that is the way he has conducted this investigation as well. And so I hope that no one is going to get in his way because he's doing a great job so far.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the end of last week, he called in two key aides to Karl Rove to testify, and that created a few ripples about exactly where he was going. Here's hoping that James Comey, who obviously is leaving for some really green pastures over at Lockheed Martin, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see who replaces him and whether or not there is some attempt to squash. And by the way, if you want to know about precedent for squashing investigations, here comes a story out of Ka-ching, Guam. U.S. grand jury opened an investigation of Jack Abramoff. You may remember him, a restaurant inside the Beltway, you know, taking checks from Indians and then stiffing them, calling them all kinds of names. You know, Tom DeLay's boy.
Right.
All right, well, there was an investigation of Jack Abramoff's role in some court revision legislation in Guam 2 years ago. But Bush removed the supervising federal prosecutor, and that effectively ended that inquiry. This is an incredible story.
It really is. You know, Mark, I think that even with, you know, we here at Air America, we follow politics very closely. So Abramoff has become a household name to us.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to most average Americans, they still don't know who this guy is. They wouldn't know Jack Abramoff from Adam. But he is a real linchpin in the money and power machine. He has been one of the most powerful, most influential, most wealthy lobbyist the Washington, D.C. has ever seen.
Yeah.
And he is coming down. But 2 years ago, Bush, before more of this stuff broke on this guy, Bush was trying to protect Abramoff.
You know, this is a scary scenario here, and we'll show you exactly what we're talking about. This situation in Guam involved allegedly a series of $9,000 checks that were actually funneled through a lawyer to actually hide Abramoff's role in all this. But this was about legislation that gave the Guam Supreme Court authority over the Superior Court. Now, what that means, in essence, is that a court paid Jack Abramoff a series of checks, in other words, paid him to lobby against another court.
Right.
Now, imagine what would happen if Clarence Thomas had been slipping some lobbyist some money to stop some piece of legislation that would have taken away power from the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
that's
twisted.
Amazing. That's it. It's even more twisted than the Indian stuff this guy was involved
in. I know. This guy, anywhere where there was money and some backroom deals to be made, you could probably find Jack Abramoff.
Yeah. God, what a sleazeball.
Yeah.
What's the future of unionism here in New York City and across America? We'll talk about that with Village Voice writer Tom Robbins, who's got a piece coming out this week about the future of unionism in New York and in America. That's coming up next. It's 27 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley, and Mark Maron will be back with us tomorrow morning. If you're just waking up, you should know that Peter Jennings lost his battle with lung cancer at the age of 67 late last evening. A real tragedy. A lot of people, certainly in the news business and the media business, mourning the passing of longtime ABC News anchor Peter Jennings. And the shuttle is not landed. It will land tomorrow morning. Sometime tomorrow morning. We're not sure exactly when. It depends on the weather. It will be landing, weather permitting. They are taking no chances. The postponement is not due to any problem with the shuttle. It has to do with low clouds over the Kennedy Space Center, where the shuttle is supposed to land. In the wake of the recent split of the AFL-CIO, the organized labor movement in America is at a crossroads. Joining us to talk more about the future of unions in America is the Village Voice's own Tom Robbins. Good morning, Tom. How you doing, man?
Good, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Absolutely.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this split. We've got the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, the Teamsters, and I believe Unite Now has also split off from the AFL-CIO. Am I right?
It was the USCW. And
okay.
Unite here is pending, and also there's a question whether or not the laborers and the farm workers may join them yet.
Oh, wow. So this could be a wholesale defection we're talking about here.
Altogether, you're talking potentially some 6 million members coming out of a 13 million member organization. So the two organizations, if they formed, would be roughly equal in size.
Tom, what is driving this movement away from the AFL-CIO?
There is a steady recognition, as the numbers in organized labor have slid continually over the last 20 years, that unions are headed down a path that will lead to their extinction if something does not change. And this isn't news to anyone who's involved in labor. The outsourcing of jobs to other countries, the decline in blue-collar industries and manufacturing, anti-labor legislation on a national and local level, all these things have taken a huge toll on unions. And John Sweeney, who came out of the SEIU, out of the union which has now spearheaded the pullout,
yeah,
ironically was elected as the guy who was going to turn all this around in 1995. He didn't do it. He certainly tried. He certainly did put more effort and more energy into the issue of organizing than had been done under the prior administration of the AFL, but the numbers continue to fall. And Andrew Stern, the current head of the SEIU, said, you're either going to now start changing policies in a major way, or we're going to pull out.
Now, Tom, there are some people who argue, and I've heard some of these discussions over the last few days as you know, more people find out about this split. There are some people who say this is the logical conclusion of a period, perhaps two decades long, of sweetheart deals between the union bosses and management. Any truth?
Well, there is that. Look, labor gives itself its own black eye, shoots itself in the foot, choose your metaphor, almost every day of the week in some form. Unions are imperfect, and there have been plenty of sweetheart deals. There have been plenty of fat cat labor leaders who got a lot of money and salary and did very little to serve their members. That's true. But for every one of those, there's also been unions that towed the line, that that won good contracts for their members, and that worked hard. The problem is that labor's had a terrible time getting its message out. You know, it doesn't have talk radio stations. It doesn't have a cable TV station. It hasn't been able to sell its message in a way. You know, there's not too many people who wake up on Saturday morning and think, gee, goodness, I'm glad that there are unions in this country so that I have today off. But the bottom line is that's the reason they have Saturday off.
That's an important point. Tom, I believe that union participation as a function in the workforce has declined something like from 25% down to about 8% now. Can,
on the private side, that's right.
Yeah, on the private side. Now, can these breakaway unions actually increase that number, in your judgment?
You know, that's going to be the benchmark of success. And I've asked a lot of people that question as to when should we be looking to see whether or not this split has worked. And the most optimistic forecast is that it's going to be at least 5 years down the road before we'll know. If these unions that have now pulled out, SEIU, the Teamsters, their erstwhile allies, if they want to really register with the American public that they're making a change, they're going to have to take on some major, major non-union operations. And Walmart is looming as the most likely target of that. It's the biggest employer, and it's the most virulently non-union employer.
Mm-hmm.
And if unions really want to be able to send a message and say, a union is good for you, they're going to have to go after Walmart. And I think that's what these unions are going to try to do.
Well, Walmart is going to be a pretty tough nut to crack, isn't it?
Absolutely. No, it's going to be a tremendously tough nut to crack. It's resilient. It's incredibly wealthy with deep pockets, able and willing, apparently. And when the one unit of a Walmart that managed to organize was the butchers. And as soon as they formed a union, Walmart responded by, well, we're not going to have butcher departments any longer. So you can see what extent that management there is willing to go to try to not give labor a chance to get in, get its nose under their tent. They're going to fight as hard as they can. It's going to be a very expensive, very long and risky battle. But there's another way to mark the success too, Mark, which is mm-hmm. one that, you know, a lot of people don't take stock of, which is that non-union employers always pay more simply to try to keep unions out as well. So there's a spillover effect that people in non-union workplaces have advantage of, just as a result, because the threat of unions are out there. So it's possible that an organizing drive to take down Walmart may well result in improved wages and benefits for those workers, and that, too, has got to be a plus.
Yeah. Now, Tom, one of the things that has been percolating here in New York for a number of years, and I know this because I know a lot of guys who are in the construction trades in this town, and that is the use of non-union labor in construction projects, particularly demolition and that sort of thing. Is there any possibility that the construction trade unions can make any headway in that regard other than putting a rat out in front of a building?
The problem, Mark, is big and growing bigger. You know, it used to be that non-union construction in New York City was confined to the outer boroughs, and that just about everything in the inner core of Manhattan was solidly union, and particularly new construction was solidly union. That, we can no longer say that's true. Major developers have built buildings in lower Manhattan using non-union labor, thumbing their nose at the construction unions, and the construction unions have shown themselves badly outmatched. You're right, they put the rats out there, they have mass rallies, but they've been peculiarly ineffective. Some unions have tried. The carpenters have tried very hard, the laborers have tried very hard to try to figure out some way to get in, not by attacking the workers who are working at these non-union places, but trying to organize them and sign them up into the union and bring them in. But that's really going to be another tough yardstick for labor to live up to.
Tom Robbins, I want to talk a bit about a couple of other issues real quickly, because I know you follow developments in New York, and certainly the idea of these bag searches on New York City subways and buses is an important issue, I think, for all people who live and work in the city of New York. We've seen Norman Siegel actually decide to, I believe, file suit against the city, saying that these bag searches are unconstitutional. How are New Yorkers that you're running into reacting to them? Are they kind of taking them in stride? Do they think it is a necessary thing? Do they feel safer?
Is it all right to call it a mixed bag?
Sure.
I think that New Yorkers hate being having someone challenge them and having someone ask what's in your bag in general, but that New Yorkers also want to be safe. The problem is, and I think this is what Norman Siegel's doing, is that put yourself in the shoes of someone who fits the profile of someone who's going to be stopped all the time, that every single time you go in the subway, no matter what you're carrying, you're going to be challenged about it. That's an inherent problem, and it's a challenge to the system we live in. You know, it's not as though, like, every time I go into a courthouse or a government building, I have to take everything out of my pockets and go through a magnetometer. We're not talking about that. We're talking about random checks, and we're talking about checks which are going to be inevitably prone to some kind of profiling, and that's an issue. So to the extent that the NYCLU's lawsuit is going to compel the city to try to come up with real rules and how to live up to them, I think that's to the good.
Tom, another quick take. We've seen some attacks take place, alleged racial hate crimes, and in one case a gay bashing crime in Chelsea over the weekend. Is New York becoming a less tolerant place as evinced by these attacks?
You know, those attacks are really troubling. I mean, the one out in
Flatlands.
It was Fat Nick who took the
baseball. Oh yeah, in Howard Beach. Yeah,
in Howard Beach. I mean, it was just astonishing to me that something like that would take place and that people would even rally around them. There's no question that there's a residue still of intolerance in a lot of neighborhoods. As much as we think that we've turned the corner since the days of Bensonhurst and death of Yusuf Hawkins, I think that always lurks out there. That's always a fear. I wouldn't go so far as to say we're less tolerant now, but I think that there's always that possibility in these incidents in which it broke out.
Final quick question, Tom. Are New Yorkers starting to pay attention to this mayoral race yet, and what do you see looming on the horizon as we get close to the September primary?
I think they're barely paying attention. I think it's going to take a little bit longer. Even though we're in mid-August, we've only got another month to go, really, and I see Freddie Ferrer winning the primary right now. I see Freddie Ferrer getting the 40% that he needs to avoid a runoff. And I think that's virtually by default because none of the other Democratic candidates have registered. But on the other hand, you have a mayor who apparently is on track to spend more than he spent in 2001, which is $75 million. I think he's going to spend more than that. And what's the rationale? I think that's the question. I don't understand why New Yorkers aren't asking the mayor. He told us in 2001 the reason he needed to spend so much of his money was because nobody knew who he was. Well, he's had 4 years in which everybody knows who he is, and yet he's spending as much money or more this time around. It looks like the mayor's on track to buy an election.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's just because he wants to win, maybe?
He absolutely wants to win. I think it shows how weak he is on some level. I think that a mayor who was secure in what he was doing and his policies wouldn't have to do that.
All right. Tom Robbins, as always, great to talk with you, man.
Take care.
You take care. Tom Robbins, staff writer for The Village Voice. We've got a job listing. Speaking of employment and speaking of people getting put to work, Kent Jones is going to be in here talking about the job listing momentarily. We're also going to talk later on this morning with Charles R. Cross. He is the author of Room Full of Mirrors, the new biography of Jimi Hendrix, has some very controversial things in it. For some reason, the media seems to be focusing on this allegation that Jimi Hendrix pretended he was gay to get out of military service. We'll talk to Charles R. Cross about that and a lot more. And some people in short pants and southern accents apparently took the top spot at the box office over this past weekend. And David Poland, editor of Movie City News and columnist for The Hot Button, will be joining us later to talk about those movies and the latest out of Hollywood, all coming up on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, and when I want to keep pace with the job market, I tune into Morning Sedition's Monday Job Listing every week on Air America Radio.
in to Morning Sedition weekdays from 6 to 9 on Missoula's News and Progressive Talk Station. Tune in to Morning Sedition weekdays from 6 to 9 on Missoula's News. Why is that so funny?
Missoula. That's stupid. How many times I got to say this?
Tune in to Morning... come on, man. I got to go someplace. Tune in to...
I don't even know why these things happen. It's not that funny.
Tune in to Morning Sedition. Come on. Tune in to Morning Sedition weekdays from 6 to 9 on Missoula. Tune in to Morning Sedition weekdays from 6 to... Come on. Tune in. Tune in to Morning Sedition. Damn it. I don't understand what's going on. This is stupid. How many of these I got? What are these? Tune in to Morning Sedition weekdays from 6 to 9 on the... Tune in to Morning Sedition weekdays from 6 to 9 on Missoula's News and Progressive Talk Station, 105.9 KNS.
There you have it.
Oh, man.
Hey, you know, sometimes it takes a little time to get through these things.
Yeah.
And Pashman, you need to stop recording it while he's doing it. I mean, that was really hard. And we do want to welcome KNSFM 105.9 News and Progressive Talk in Missoula, Montana, and KSZL 1230 AM in Victor Valley, California. Welcome to the Morning Sedition family, y'all.
That's right. And that sound of Mark Maron that you heard on that tape, he's not here today, but he will be back tomorrow. Do not worry.
He will?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
They told me they were going to let blacks run this thing for them.
They always tell you that.
They lied. Yeah. They lied. Like Bush, they lied.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Well, we got somebody here that's not lying.
All right.
He's got a job listing for you. His name is Kent Jones. Good morning, Kent.
Good morning, guys. Here we go. We know a lot of people out there are out of work and spend your Sunday leaping through the want ads or through Monster.com. We want to help. To be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here's the Morning Sedition Monday Help Wanted listing. Background, a company called Prolacta Bioscience is trying to market human breast milk by selling it to hospitals to treat sick infants.
Whoa.
And it looks like they're hiring. Got job? Medicinal beverage company seeks harvesters. Do you suck? Then we may have just the job for you. We are looking for sensitive individuals who know how to squeeze the most out of their work. Strong oral skills are required, but please note, this is also a hands-on position.
Whoa.
The ideal candidate will be able to skillfully manipulate their sources to produce a steady stream of results. Nutritious meals provided right on the job. Biters and the lactose intolerant need not apply. If interested, please send resume and references. Also, flowers would be a good start. Please also see our ad under Dairy Producers. Women are especially encouraged to apply.
Whoa.
That was your Monday job listing.
Hey, wait a minute. Lactose intolerant, that discriminates against blacks.
Oh, it does not.
I'm just checking. Maybe there's a Major League Baseball player that might want to go in for that job. His name, of course, is Rafael Palmeiro, first baseman for the Baltimore Orioles. Dan Pashman, you follow the game?
Yes.
The man is now in the middle of serving a 10-game suspension for testing positive for steroids. His Hall of Fame career is in much jeopardy.
It's true, Mark, and the 10-game suspension is really a slap on the wrist in any respect, but especially in comparison to the real penalty that he's going to suffer, which is the penalty to his reputation and to his chances of getting into the Hall of Fame, where he most likely would have gotten before this scandal. But, you know, now Congress wants to investigate this guy for perjury, and we had Bush over the weekend defending him as if he knows anything from anything on this issue, you know.
Yeah, I can't quite figure out exactly what's up with that, because I don't remember him, like, defending Barry Bonds, who has never been proven to have taken steroids.
Right. Well, I think, Palmeiro played on the Texas Rangers when Bush owned the team.
Oh, and so they were buds from back then.
Right. Well, according to Bush, they were quote-unquote buds. I doubt Bush spent all that much time talking to the players and hanging out in the locker room. But, you know, it's just, it's Bush sticking his nose into a story. I don't even understand why he wants to defend Palmero, frankly. I mean,
well,
like,
you know, maybe there's an answer in the pages of Jose Canseco's book, because Canseco alleged that Bush, when he was a partner in the Texas Rangers, knew about steroid abuse, did nothing about it, and guess who Rafael Palmero was playing for during that particular time?
The Texas Rangers.
Exactly. Tom Davis, Republican of Virginia, where they just got themselves a baseball team in the play, face of the Washington Nationals, he's chair of the House Government Reform Committee, and he says that they're going to start interviewing potential witnesses once they've gotten the drug testing records for Rafael Palmero. So they want to know exactly when he tested positive for steroids, whether he tested positive perhaps before that testimony in Congress, or whether he tested positive, which is more likely, before they had the big 3,000 hit thing for him.
Right.
In other words, did they do that big ceremony knowing that he had already tested positive for steroids?
It's. I have a feeling, Mark, that this is going to get bigger before it goes away. And I think that also baseball and Congress really want to hold Palmero up as an example to the rest of Major League Baseball players. They want to show the players that they are serious about steroids, that they're not just going to go after the... Because before, up to Palmero, every guy who had been busted for steroids, this is the first year they've had testing, every guy's been busted. It was basically a scrub, a bench player. This guy's big time.
He's a big time player.
And they're going to make a lesson out of him.
Now, quick question, Dan Patrick.
Yes, sir.
Because we'll let you be the judge here. Jim Bunning, senator from Kentucky and former Hall of Fame... Hall of Fame pitcher,
right,
says that there ought to be a 2-year suspension for any professional athlete in a team sport who tests positive for steroids. Do you agree with that?
I think 2 years goes too far for a first offense. I like Bud Selig, the commissioner of Major League Baseball's plan. He says 50 games on the first offense, 100 games on the second offense, lifetime ban on the third offense.
The third
offense. I think that's pretty stiff.
All right. Well, when we... get finished with the new... God, I keep saying when we come back. You know, I'm starting to scare myself. Coming up next, we're going to be talking with Charles R. Cross. He's the author of a new book on Jimi Hendrix called Room Full of Mirrors. It debunks a lot of myths about Jimi Hendrix and maybe creates a few of its own. We're going to talk with him next. This is Air America Radio's Mornings Edition at 57 past the hour. Dan, what are you doing at my high school prom? Good morning. This is Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio at 6 minutes past the hour. And we want to say a special good morning to two new Air America Radio affiliates. We are on starting today in Missoula, Montana on KNS FM 105.9 News and Progressive Talk and KSZL 1230 AM in Victor Valley, California. And we want to remind you that Mark Maron is not here. I did not kill him. He has not been fired. He will be back tomorrow. He was doing the gig at Giggles in Seattle, Washington.
Yes.
Join us. That's both me and Mark, but you're not touching me this Friday when we broadcast live from O'Neill's on 64th Street in Manhattan. That's between Broadway and Central Park West. We'll have the usual free coffee, which is really good, and some cool giveaways, which is also really good. Dan Pashman, the giveaway king, will be probably doing another one of the raffles that he's become famous for at our remote broadcast. Stay tuned for more details. That's this Friday from 6 to 9 a.m. at O'Neill's on West 64th Street. Rolling Stone magazine named Jimi Hendrix the greatest guitarist of all times, and I would concur. Since his death in 1970, Hendrix has sold over 50 million albums. Our next guest is the author of the new Hendrix biography, Room Full of Mirrors. He's also the author of Heavier Than Heaven, the biography of Kurt Cobain. Now, live on the phone from Seattle, Washington, is Charles R. Cross. Welcome to the show, Charles. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you for being with us at an ungodly hour in the morning.
I just been at Giggles last night and just stayed up all night.
Oh, there you go. That's fantastic. You know, I am old enough to remember my euphoria at first hearing the Are You Experienced album, hearing Purple Haze and hearing those notes and thinking to myself, I had never heard music like this before. You have gone deep into Jimi Hendrix's background. Tell us first and foremost a bit about how he developed into the rock icon he is today.
Well, he grew up very, very poor in a situation that we have to describe as very impoverished, and I think you have to also say there was some abuse and neglect in his childhood. You know, Seattle didn't have a ghetto the way some East Coast cities did, but nonetheless, there was a huge divide between white and black Seattle, certainly in terms of economic opportunity. And Jimmy got out of Seattle by joining the 101st Airborne in the U.S. Army, which happened to a lot of African Americans in that era.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been caught driving in a stolen car and was looking at a five-year prison sentence. And so he joined the Army and ended up going into the 101st Airborne, which is the toughest part of the Army, too. And at that point, he had played guitar for 2 or 3 years prior to that.
But he had started late, hadn't he?
He did. He only started when he was 16 or so. And then he got down in the South and started playing some of the great clubs within what they call the Chitlin' Circuit, and really got exposed to a whole taste of blues and R&B that he'd never really experienced before.
Was he self-taught?
He was. Never took a single lesson in his entire life. And it's remarkable. Jimmy died at 27. The recording you're talking about, Are You Experienced? He'd only been playing guitar for 6 years at the point that he made that record,
wow.
Which is really quite remarkable.
Yeah, it certainly is. Now, you know, one of the things that's interesting, Charles R. Cross, is that the media seems to have focused in on the revelation in your book that Jimi Hendrix pretended he was gay to get out of the service. A, are you surprised that the media is focusing on that? And B, are there other revelations in the book that you figure are equally as newsworthy?
Well, I'm a little surprised there's so much attention, because historically, as a biographer, my job is to put things in the context of the times. And in the early 60s, you know, it was very common for people trying to get out of the Army that way. I mean, I joke that Jimmy was sort of the Corporal Klinger from MASH of the 101st Airborne, you know. He was doing all sorts of outrageous things. And the documents are just absolutely amazing. He also was openly masturbating in front of his bunkmates, just trying to get kicked out. He couldn't be more odd at the time. So I am a little surprised that there was so much attention to that, because it wasn't uncommon for people to try to do all sorts of things to get out of the service. There are a number of other shocking revelations that I think are even more significant. One, musically, which I thought was just fascinating, was that, you know, we all think of Jimmy on stage at Woodstock playing the Star Spangled Banner.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I discovered is he wanted to go on stage at Woodstock playing acoustic guitar.
Really?
The promoters would not let him. And you just imagine, you know, a whole different route to his life and maybe even to the 60s if he would have come on and played acoustic guitar and done an African or Moroccan style music, which he was becoming more interested in at that point in his life.
You know, it's fascinating you bring that up, because I had heard stories at around the time he played at Woodstock that he really believed that his version of the Star Spangled Banner, which was, by the way, very widely vilified by in some quarters at the time, he really did think that it was patriotic, did he?
He did, and that was one of the most fascinating things. I interviewed Eric Burden of the Animals, a great singer, and he told a great story of being on the rooftop of Jimmy's London's flat at a time when there was a huge protest down below against the Vietnam War. And Burden turned to Jimmy and said, "Wow, you know, aren't you with all these people? Isn't this great?" And Jimmy had exactly the opposite response, which no one would have expected. Jimmy went into a big, long rant, which could be on something that aired on the Rush Limbaugh show, about the communist threat. And, you know, by being a soldier and having been indoctrinated in the service, he was afraid of the Red Chinese, he said.
Wow.
And so he had very mixed feelings political. I mean, I think he evolved, as did everybody. And of course, you know, nobody really could be in support of a quagmire that was Vietnam, just like I don't understand how anyone can be in support of the quagmire we have now that's called Iraq. But Jimmy had very torn feelings about that. He was not as people presented him.
Charles R. Cross is our guest. He's the author of Room Full of Mirrors, a biography of Jimi Hendrix. Charles, talk, if you would, a bit about Jimmy's music. I remember an album coming out called Get That Feeling, I think it was called, that was done by, produced by a guy named Curtis Knight, who Jimmy had played with. And I was surprised at the time, because it didn't sound a lot like Are You Experienced. But what was going on? And by the way, I think that album came out before, or actually I think it was recorded, or at least he played before he went to England. Am I wrong about that?
Well, a combination of things. That album is really a mishmash of a number of different sessions, some of which are billed as Jimi Hendrix, but don't actually even feature him. Jimmy, you know, his business life was a mess. He was so singularly focused on music and creating it that he signed a number of very bad contracts. And he signed one contract with a New York producer early in his career, and some of those recordings later came out. Some of them are good. There's some of them are really good R&B, but there also is some inferior recordings. You know, with the experience, he only released three records during his lifetime. It's a very small catalog, and then there's, of course, the Great Band of Gypsies live record.
Yeah.
But what's remarkable is that, you know, for such small body of work, how every guitar lick, even that record you're talking about, fans track down because they want to know everything the man played. He still has such a tremendous influence 35 years after his death.
Charles, this is Dan Pashman here. You know, one of the things that struck me in the book, I love the story of him going to jam with Cream and how the guys in Cream were just shocked that someone was asking if they could come on stage with him because no one had ever even had that kind of gall to say, can I jam with Cream, please? And he may have been insecure in some ways in his personal life, but it seemed to me that he was just full of confidence in his musical ability and really had a great deal of hubris almost that ended up serving him well. How about that?
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. He had hubris. And there's some great stories early on of Jimmy running into Albert King and B.B. King and all these great blues guys. And normally they don't share licks, but when Jimmy came to them, they were shocked that this young man would even ask, how did you do that? And so they showed him things. And I also describe him in the book as sort of a musical cannibal. He was able to play with these people and take all their influences. Yet when you listen to Jimmy's music, it's not like he's aping someone else. It's like he's created his own unique sound out of all those myriad of different influences.
Now, Charles R. Cross, how did Jimi Hendrix react to the idea that many in the black community did not care for his music? I know that I was branded as a hippie for listening to Jimi Hendrix's music by most black people I knew at the time.
Well, race at the time was really a lens in this country that you had to look at everything from. I mean, Jimi had a great musical career, but I also think he's remarkable for being one of the first white artists to attract black artists to attract a large African-American following. And the FBI was investigating it because they thought that was dangerous. Sadly, though, the African-American community, as you noted, didn't embrace him. And one of the most remarkable stories in the book is 2 weeks after Woodstock, he plays a free festival up on Lenox Avenue and 135th in Harlem, and he's booed, and he's shown up by a big R&B singer named Big Maybelle. And so, you know, 2 weeks before he's playing, and it's really absolutely, in my opinion, the seminal moment of the 60s, but just a couple weeks later, he's being booed because he has a Puerto Rican girlfriend who people think is white. You really have to look at his life in the sense of how the 60s was so still defined by race in America. And I think one of my favorite stories in the book is when Jimmy comes back to America after he's a star in England. He stops in New York in the summer of 1967, where he's unknown, goes into a hotel, and is mistaken by a woman as the bellhop.
Jeez.
To imagine, you know, what he would have thought at that, because here he is a huge star, and yet in America it's the color of his skin that still is the defining thing. And I think his whole life was forever torn by the conflicting things of what race in America meant in his lifetime, in the late 60s and early 70s.
Charles R. Cross, one final quick question. There has been a lot of mythology that sprung up around Jimi Hendrix's death. He did, in fact, choke on his own vomit, right?
He did.
Now, what is the mythology? What did you find out when you investigated what truly did happen?
Well, one of the most controversial things is the woman who was next to him, her name was Monica Donovan, and she presented herself as Jimmy's fiance. And basically, all these years, she lied about, you know, why he died and how he died. And she claimed it was medical malfeasance and all these ridiculous stories. And what's very clear from looking at the record is that it was an accidental drug overdose combined with he'd taken way too many sleeping pills combined with drinking. And it's a sad story because the mixture of drugs and alcohol is a lethal mixture, and it's killed more than a few rock stars and more than a few people. But Jimmy clearly wanted to live. He was a very vibrant man. And it's just such a shame that we only got 27 years of his great, work on this earth.
Charles R. Cross, thank you so much for being with us. The name of the
You're
book,
welcome.
Room Full of Mirrors, a biography of Jimi Hendrix. It's been a very enlightening time.
Thank you.
You take care. It's 18 minutes past the hour, and we're going to give you the top news stories of the day. And we're also going to talk later with David Poland from Movie City News. We're going to talk about who won, who lost in this past weekend's box office, and how the summer is looking thus far. Stay with us. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Is it possible for you to shut the fuck up for 10 seconds?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Twenty-three minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with us tomorrow morning, live here in studio. He's on his way back from Seattle after doing the gig at Giggles. And the world is mourning the passing of one of the most visible people in the United States, and that is, of course, news anchor Peter Jennings. He, of course, was the anchorman on the World News Tonight for some 20-odd years. He was actually began his network news anchoring back in 1965 at the age of 26. He passed away last night at the age of 67. Lung cancer was the cause. Apparently had quit smoking for like 20-some-odd years and then began again after September 11th, which certainly was a traumatic experience for an awful lot of folks. And Peter Jennings actually made one final broadcast message, which he taped on April 5th, 2005. We're going to go to that message right now.
Finally this evening, a brief note about change. Some of you have noticed in the last several days that I was not covering the Pope. While my colleagues at ABC did a superb job, I did think a few times I was missing out. However, as some of you now know, I have learned in the last couple of days that I have lung cancer. Yes, I was a smoker until about 20 years ago. And I was weak, and I smoked over 9/11. But whatever the reason, the news does slow you down a bit. I've been reminding my colleagues today, who have all been incredibly supportive, that almost 10 million Americans are already living with cancer, and I have a lot to learn from them. And living is the key word. The National Cancer Institute says that we are survivors from the moment of diagnosis. I will continue to do the broadcast. On good days, my voice will not always be like this. Certainly, it's been a long time, and I hope it goes without saying that a journalist who doesn't value deeply the audience's loyalty should be in another line of work. To be perfectly honest, I'm a little surprised at the kindness today from so many people. That's not intended as false modesty, but even I was taken aback by how far and how fast news travels. Finally, I wonder if other men and women ask their doctors right away, okay, doc, when does the hair go? At any rate, that's it for now on World News Tonight. Have a good evening. I'm Peter Jennings. Thanks and good night.
The late Peter Jennings, dead at the age of 67 from lung cancer. And he was not the only person who passed away in recent days. Ibrahim Ferrer, who was the co-founder of the Buena Vista Social Club, a groundbreaking Latin music ensemble, passed away at the age of 78. Lucky Thompson, very noted jazz musician, actually passed away July 30th. It's just word is now filtering to us about the passing of Lucky Thompson, extraordinary musician who really gave a lot of people a lot of joy as well, Dan Pashman.
It's true. It's true. And just to add to that, I mean, Robin Cook as well, a real British political prodigy.
Yes.
And a fierce opponent of the war in Iraq who resigned his position, actually, over as foreign secretary.
As foreign secretary.
Resigned his position in protest of Tony Blair's decision to go into Iraq. Passed away, and we're still awaiting a cause of death there. He's only 59 years old.
Only 59 years old, and we don't know yet what killed him. The space shuttle is still up in the air. For those of you who are just getting up, it is not coming down until tomorrow morning. It was scheduled first to come down at 4:46 a.m. Eastern Time. That was called off at 3:17 a.m., and that was over concerns about low cloud levels. Nothing wrong with the shuttle. The second opportunity was at 6:22 a.m., right after we had gone on the air. When we got in this morning, we were hearing that it was going to be at 6:22, but just after 5 a.m. Eastern Time, NASA determined that the weather was technically in a go state, but that the conditions were too unstable for the shuttle to land. It is a very important thing. thing for this thing, for the shuttle, you know, to make a proper reentry and a proper landing. So the next window of opportunity will be tomorrow morning.
It's true. And I don't mean to be overly pessimistic, but I think CNN is just praying this thing's going to go up in flames.
You're a maudlin guy. We've got David Pollan, editor of Movie City News and columnist of The Hot Button, to tell us all the latest dirt on Hollywood. Coming up next here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. This is Air America Radio's Morning Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with us tomorrow. And we want to welcome again two new Air America Radio affiliates. We are on the air in Missoula, Montana on KNSFM 105.9 News and Progressive Talk and KSZL 1230 AM in Victor Valley, California. Joining us now to give us his take on the weekend box office along with some other Hollywood scoop is the editor of Movie City News and a columnist for thehotbutton.com, David Pollan. David, welcome back. How you doing, man?
I am well, and of course, I was born in Missoula, Montana.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Complete lie, sorry.
Oh.
I'm from Hollywood. I couldn't help myself.
Somehow I should have known that. Brendan McDonald is here with us in the studio because he follows the movie.
Yes, Hollywood, man. This is my bag, too.
Yeah. Now, let's start out with the Dukes of Hazzard. Those hillbillies won, huh?
Yeehaw.
Yeah. Did they do as well as everyone expected?
You know, it was a weird movie because it did exactly right in the middle of where everybody expected. Either there were people who believed it was going to do $20 million, there were people who thought it was going to do $50 million plus. So it did almost exactly right down the middle between the expectations. So it was fine.
I mean, this was marketed pretty hardcore, though, David, to the younger demographic, people who might not even had any nostalgia for the TV show. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's kind of Maxim Magazine, the movie. Nice one. She spends a lot of time. I mean, the funny thing is, you see when you finally see the movie, and I went on Saturday night because I felt compelled to actually see this thing after it was doing so much business. And you actually see more of the car. The car does more acting than any of the actors. And I think you actually have more car time watching this picture than you do movie time or character time.
So it's a big second unit movie.
All second unit, all the time.
All right.
I think the guy actually should have gotten credit. He also did the incredible car sequences in The Bourne Supremacy.
Same guy.
So it's pretty amazing, actually, the car work. But a very powerful, powerful acting performance by Jessica Simpson's breasts.
Now, David Poland, we were all a little taken aback, I guess, in hearing the news that Sony made a deal to actually refund people's money. I guess the deal has expired by now, but to refund people's money who were sent to movie theaters based on the opinions of a fake and quotes from a fake movie critic.
Yeah, it's as much of a deal as you can make when you have a gun pointed to your head. I mean, it wasn't exactly their choice, but yeah, I mean, they made the deal. This was the settlement, and basically, Sony would like to see it go away.
But this was the guy. David Manning was the fake critic. Is that who this
David
was?
David Manning of the Hartford Courant, I believe it was.
Current.
Current. Excuse me.
I lived in Hartford.
There you go.
And he's not making that up.
Yeah.
That's exactly. It's what happens when you're out there, but.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, David Manning was just a really bad idea in-house that just kind of almost was like an in-house joke that kind of went too far. And it's really one of the ugly moments in the history of cinema.
But, I mean, did they really need to do this? It dawns on me, David, at some point that you can get a lot of the press to, I mean, you can usually find somebody that liked the movie somewhere.
Yeah, essentially what happened was that they skipped a step and everybody kind of went wink, wink. And it didn't really, you know, in the real world of movie quotes, it's really not that big a deal to get anybody to say anything you want. They just kind of skipped a step and then went, oh, well, whatever. And they got caught.
Well, you used to do a pretty good service for people, David. You had a thing called the Quote Whore Scorecard. Can you explain a little bit about that?
We used to do the Quote Whore Scoreboard every week. We'd actually have a little scoreboard like a football game and rack up how many quotes different people got. So there were people who are really quote people who go to junkets all the time and do nothing much more than quote. I mean, you really don't know them for other things.
Right.
And then there are people like Peter Travers from Rolling Stone who
actually quote before they print.
Oh, it's terrible. Travers' name, I always see it attached to the most, you know, I guess Gene Shalit's another one of those guys where you see them actually formulating their quote before they're even done with the movie.
Well, Peter's one of those unusual characters who works for a major paper, an outlet, being Rolling Stone, and who actually can quote months and months early before ever actually printing a word. Most people have very strict rules in newspapers about what they print and when they print it, and then when they're quoted. So he's a unique breed, shall we say.
David Poland is our guest. He's the editor of Movie City News and columnist for thehotbutton.com. I got to ask you, because I've heard this guy's name over the years about a zillion times. Army Archer apparently is retiring from doing a column for Variety after, what, 50-some-odd years?
Yep.
Which is almost more than I am old. Has it made any noise out in Hollywood that this guy... Because, I mean, I used to hear his name all the time.
Yeah, Army is one of those kind of institutions that's been there forever and has in many ways been, you know, lost in it a bit. I mean, people kind of have... He's very old-fashioned that way. He's actually a nice columnist. And evil columnists have become the thing. I mean, I guess they always were. Really, he came up in the era of Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons.
But define evil columnist. What are you getting at?
Well, evil columnist is somebody who, well, you know, there are sites like The Famer where all they do is write about Jessica Simpson's rear end.
Right.
And, you know, who Britney Spears is sleeping with and what size bosom is this week going to be in Herbie the Love Bug this week. And then, you know... You have evil columnists who are actually like Us Magazine and those things that who were actually looking to, you know, check out your trash every week to find out what the DNA results might be.
Right.
So.
Well, there's also a kind of insidious, a kind of a covert evil columnist archetype that I notice at major news organizations where the person passes him or herself off as a critic when really what they're doing is gossip mongering and I think one of the guys that stands out most in my mind, and I don't know if it's okay to get you to name names here, but there's this guy.
For Roger Freeman.
There you go. We got him. And,
wait a minute. There we go.
Anybody at the austere Fox News, obviously, you know, is taken a little bit into question for me right away. But explain to me a little bit about why Roger Friedman falls into this category.
Well, shockingly enough, I think Roger actually gives Fox News a bad name. You know, really a challenge. Roger is a guy who is actually very much from the old school, who actually hold out and do... if you do something that he thinks is wrong to him personally, he will actually attack what you do over and over again. So, for instance, for the last month or so, we've gotten relentless attacks on Steven Spielberg and DreamWorks and anything having to do with War of the Worlds.
And why would he do that?
It turns out that he couldn't get a screening of War of the Worlds before he went on vacation at one point. And nobody in the...
Hold up for a second, David.
Yeah.
This guy went ballistic over not getting a screening of a film before he went on vacation?
Yeah, he wanted to go on vacation, and they wouldn't show it to New York Times either, but they wouldn't show it to Roger, so therefore they had done something horrible to him. Same thing, of course, he did a couple years ago was Drew Barrymore became evil in his column for an entire month. It became how evil is Drew Barrymore and how terrible is Charlie's Angels 2 because she didn't talk to him at the premiere. Really had nothing to do with the fact the movie was terrible and horrible. It had to do with the fact that he had been snubbed and didn't get the access to the talent he wanted, so therefore he took it out of the movie for as long as he could. It's that kind of, you know, and that is something that Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper were actually known for. People have talked about the fact that, you know, he's considered old-fashioned and kind of it's the tradition of columnists. And, of course, I think it's tradition of people with heads up their rectum.
Right. Well, it screws you, too, David. I mean, it screws all journalists that are actually trying to do a job here and do something that is actually like a consumer report on with film criticism because it sours the waters, doesn't it?
Well, it's funny because I was just reading another piece on the summer and how the big movies have crashed and burned, and it's this, you know, this is kind of the summer of finding somebody else to blame.
Right. Well, how has this
summer? Who are they
gone?
Blaming?
Yeah.
They're blaming the slump. They're blaming, you know, circumstances. They're blaming Jamie Foxx for not being a big enough star. They're blaming Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson. They're blaming anybody they can because essentially when you have a, you know, $150 million movie that flops, nobody's happy.
Right.
So there are all these, you know, this is the summer where everybody has an excuse for everything. And, that's what happens is you start making these excuses. And so when Roger Friedman does something like that, you know, they kind of understand it's Roger and that's his unique, horrible self, but at the same time, that becomes a tone that gets set for columnists. Same thing is true on the Internet in general. When people on the Internet behave badly, somehow even, you know, people you have a relationship with will tend to tar you with that brush. And that's the frustrating part of guys out there being in the, you know, punch bowl.
Well, if the guys like that are out there digging up the crap and blaming people, one of the reasons we love having you on the show, David, is because you and everybody at Movie City News really seems to be able to cut to the quick. And so tell us, what is, putting blame aside, what is the success story of the summer in your eyes?
Well, there are many small success stories of the summer. There have been, you know, this is the thing, is it is not the summer of the biggest numbers ever. However, movies like The Dukes of Hazzard, you know, love it or hate it, is a success story. Mm-hmm. Certainly Wedding Crashers is one of the biggest stories.
Well, and that's a real word-of-mouth hit. It's maintaining its presence in the top spots for these weeks.
Hey, what's up with
this? People are friends of mine at New Line who, you know, are talking to just in the last few days. You know, we were having a discussion about it and said, you know, if you had told me a month ago that movie was going to be doing 19% drops in the month of August, they would have laughed at you.
Right, 19%.
Even the people who loved it and nurtured it, you know, are stunned how incredibly well it's done.
Right, 19% meaning from the week before, it's only losing that percentage of its audience.
But, David, what's up with this Penguin movie?
Well, the Penguin movie has got a little bit, is remarkable amount of ink considering the fact that it's only going to do $35, $40 million, but... it's a movie that actually hits the children family niche, which is very oddly enough, the summer you never have enough comedies and you never enough family movies because everybody wants during the summer, the kids want to get out of the house and people want to get their children out of their house. And you know, this summer it's been movies like that. It's movies like Herbie the Love Bug, movies like another one that's a surprise hit is Sky High, which is doing, you know, probably around $60 million when all said and done, because people want to have something to go to with the kids. And March of the Penguins has been sold brilliantly as a family movie, even though there are, you know, birds eating birds and things dying and killing. And
yeah, it doesn't seem like a family movie to me just because of the nature of, you know, the reality of Antarctic living. But I guess there's something cuddly and cute about a baby penguin.
Well, there's always something cuddly and cute about a baby penguin. Of course, now everybody in town is talking about how they're going to do the next Penguin movie.
Right. Well, there is a movie out right now called Grizzly Man, which they might be trying to make that into the Cuddly Bear movie, but that's pretty gruesome, isn't it?
It's extremely gruesome, and God bless it, one and all. It's Werner Herzog, who is, you know, a crazy man, and a brilliant crazy man at that.
Oh, yeah.
And he takes this found footage from Timothy Treadwell, who was a survivalist and into the bear scene, was the only guy who went up and lived with a grizzly bear for 5 summers, who eventually was killed by the grizzly bears. And so Timothy has this very upbeat idea of nature and the world, and Werner Herzog feels that, you know, Timothy does not understand that the world is about death and murder. You know, it's fabulously...
Hey, I saw Strozzi. I saw Strozzi, and that was certainly about death and murder, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Death and murder is very a fun subject.
Yeah. David Poland, as always, great to have you with us. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure to be there.
All right. Thanks, David.
David Poland, editor of Movie City News and columnist of thehotbutton.com. You know, Brendan, it's really strange. Werner Herzog is really an out guy. Have you ever seen any of the documentaries about the movies that he made?
No, but I've heard that there's a great one about his relationship with
Klaus Kinski. Yeah,
and I mean, I've seen the film Aguirre, The Wrath of God, which, you know, that as good of a movie that is, that a documentary on the making of that film would be just as interesting or better because of the personalities involved.
Yeah, and Stroitzik was one of the strangest films it was just so relentlessly bleak.
Yeah. But I like how we are talking about the Werner Herzog movies and meanwhile at the top of the box office is Jessica Simpson and Short Shorts. I think we're on the wrong page with the general public, Riley.
I think we might well be, but we're on the right page with Air America listeners, because we've got the liberal agenda coming up. We're going to talk more about Bush's falling poll numbers in Iraq when we can I keep saying the wrong thing. Coming up next on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
That's called a brain skin, folks. And I've had a couple this morning. It's 52 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Reilly. You're listening to Air America Radio. Mark Maron will be back with us tomorrow. And this Friday, we're all going to be broadcasting live from O'Neill's on 64th Street between Broadway and Central Park West right here in New York City. We'll have free coffee, other really cool giveaways. Stay tuned for more details. That's this Friday, 6 to 9 a.m. at O'Neill's on West 64th Street. And, ladies and gentlemen, George W. Bush's poll numbers portend. Now, he says he doesn't read his poll numbers. Yeah. He says he doesn't pay any attention to his poll numbers.
Right.
We know better. Every action this man seems to have taken over the last 6 months or so has been in direct response to his poll numbers, Dan Pashman.
It's true, Mark. It's true. And here we see 61% now disapprove of Bush's handling of Iraq. That's the most, the highest percent disapproving of the war, of his handling of the war, rather. But I think the most of all these poll numbers, which all say he's going down and which all say that the veneer is being pulled away, the one that I think is most interesting, 64% think Iraq has not made the U.S. safer from terrorism.
That is the most since the start of the Iraq War. 54% are dissatisfied with the direction things are going in the United States of America.
Yeah.
And when you ask people, how long would you personally support keeping large numbers of U.S. military troops in Iraq? Less than one more year, 38%. Bring them home now, 12%. Between those two numbers, that's half the population.
Yeah.
Now, they're 26% in fairness, say as long as it takes to achieve U.S. goals. But I imagine if you went back a year or so and looked at those numbers, you'd find a lot more people saying as long as it takes.
That's right. That's right. And while these poll numbers are bad, it's looking like it's only going to get worse. There's a story developing out of Crawford, Texas, Mark, with relation to the Iraq war that I think the Bush administration is praying will go away, but we're not going to let it go away. We're going to stay on this here on Air America. We're actually hoping to get Cindy Sheehan on our show, but this is a mother, Mark, who we've talked about on the show in the past.
We've talked about Cindy Sheehan before. She lost her son, Casey, in Iraq, and she has not stopped taking the Bush administration to task as a direct result. And she is in Crawford, Texas. She met Saturday afternoon with two high-level Bush officials, but that's not good enough. She wants to meet with the president himself so that she can understand exactly why he got us into this in the first place and why her son did not die in vain. She ought to get the Nobel Peace Prize for this, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, she's really phenomenal. And what, real quick, I want to throw out this quote. You know, they sent out National Security Advisor Steve Hadley and Deputy White House Chief of Staff Joe Hagan out to talk to her, try to mollify her, which means shut her up, essentially.
Yeah.
And Hagan said to this woman who lost her child in Iraq, quote, I want to assure you that he, meaning Bush, really does care.
Oh, yeah.
Screw you. You
I'm
think he
that.
Really cares? That guy doesn't care about one soldier that we've lost in Iraq.
Well, certainly, if he went by how many funerals he's gone to, he cares about none of them.
Exactly.
Absolutely
the
none of them.
The nerve to say something like that.
But he cares about somebody camping out in front of his ranch now because he sees his poll numbers are going down. He sees there's a problem in Iraq that's not going away. And he needs to deal with her. And maybe he'll get, you know, maybe she'll get lucky and he will, in fact, come out. My guess is the right-wing talk show hosts are going to start a slamming, you know, real soon.
That's a good prediction.
Whoa, I hear a fax machine. That means Kent Jones is here with the liberal marching orders.
There's the fax from the Streisand compound here with our liberal agenda for the week. Get out a pen, write these down. One, say you support intelligent design, but only when it refers to mountain bikes and espresso machines. Two, protest the Dukes of Hazzard's car because the General Lee isn't a hybrid vehicle. Three, have Crawford Ranch redistricted as a no-work zone.
Yeah.
Four, call Robert Novak a tool and see if he flips out again.
Uh-oh.
Five, to compete with all those people naming everything after Ronald Reagan, go around the country naming roads and parks after Michael Dukakis.
Whoa!
Today's phrase, just dropping into conversation. Hey, all you moms who went to Bush's ranch to protest the war, you're wasting your time. Wake up, sheeple. Don't you realize nothing gets accomplished in Crawford ever? That's what it's for. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kent Jones. Thank you very much, Dan Pashman.
My pleasure. Thanks, Riley.
What's his name is back to me? What's that guy's name again?
Fred Maron?
Fred Maron? Ted Maron.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah.
Sparon Maron. Mark Maron returns tomorrow. We've also got tomorrow Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh from The New Yorker. Man who takes care of plenty of business.
That's right. That's right. And we got another very exciting guest.
Former Husker Du singer. I'm sorry. Husker Du and Sugar frontman Bob Mould.
Yes.
He's here with us to perform.
He is awesome. Really great. We're very excited. He's going to be playing here live in the studio for us. So, very exciting.
Folks, thank you all very much. Thank you, Chris Lopresto, Brendan, B. Mac McDonald, Kent Jones, Dan Pashman, the two giants in the back, all of you who have been with us this morning. Made my job easy today, y'all.
Morning Sedition.